This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest, Doug Glanville, is a former Major League Baseball player, but hardly a typical pro athlete. Before getting into the game, he got an engineering degree from an Ivy League school, and he now writes columns about the world of sports for the New York Times. His new book, The Game From Where I Stand, is an inside look at the culture of pro baseball, with subjects as trivial as how to pack your bag when you've been cut from a team, and as serious as managing romantic relationships and facing the end of a promising career. Glanville spent 15 years in professional baseball, 9 seasons in the big leagues with the Chicago Cubs, Philadelphia Phillies, and Texas Rangers. Besides writing columns for the Times, he's a baseball analyst for ESPN. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Doug Glanville, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, because Fresh Air is produced in Philadelphia, which is where you played the most of your major league career, I was certainly aware of you as a ballplayer for many years and was aware that you were a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania. And I wanted to begin by asking you whether you felt a little different from a lot of the guys around you. You know, there's this image of ballplayers. Maybe it's exaggerated and outdated, but, you know, guys who chew tobacco, spit, scratch themselves, don't read books without pictures, and you're this Ivy League guy with an engineering degree. Did you feel you were different from your teammates?
Now, the interesting thing about that is it started more when I first got drafted. I think it converged to much more of a common space if you look from the minor league experience versus the major league experience. And I think of the movie Bull Durham, where Crash Davis is talking to the main character, who's played by Tim Robbins, and he says, you know, you have fungus in your shower shoes. And he said, in the minor leagues, you're a slob, but in the big leagues, they can consider you colorful. So I think the fact that I was different with this sort of academic background that's maybe not associated with professional athletes, that became something that was very much of a unique interest level for Major League Baseball. In minor leagues, it was sort of, you know, you were kind of the alien in the room more so. And but it was interesting how it changed over the years and became more and more something positive.
Your degree was in engineering. Did those skills translate at all, give you an edge in the game, you know, which obviously involves angles and dimensions and fast calculations?
Well, I thought it would be more of an advantage than it ended up, actually. You know, I used to get teased as being called the rocket scientist when I was with the Cubs. And you realize fairly quickly at the professional level, you have to have moments where you're sort of blank. You're not thinking, you're not calculating. You're just in a space to perform and react and trust your instincts. Yes, you can use the engineering to prepare. That was very important. I had a system. I had to figure out, why does this guy throw pitches in a pattern so I could be prepared? Those things mattered, and it certainly helped that I had an academic approach to preparing for my opponent and also to figure out what I'm doing wrong to make corrections. But in the end, a lot of it is instinct, and your preparation can be well-crafted and sort of engineered, but when it comes down to it, you have to react to that ball because you have a split second to make a decision.
Now, baseball is different from other sports in that there's typically this long apprenticeship in the minor leagues. I mean, in a lot of sports, you'll see a player drafted and will become a pro that year or the next year and have a big impact. In baseball, folks spend years in the minors. You were a first-round pick in 1991, and I guess your first big league year was what, 96?
1996, yes.
Yeah, so give us an example of something you learned in the minors that – you know, that tells us how you weren't ready. I mean, why do you need to spend all those years in the minors?
Well, absolutely, I was not ready. If I was drafted and went to the Major League Baseball, I would have been very quickly an engineer right away. I feel like there was a lot of components to baseball, particularly. You can master one aspect, and then there's other aspects you have to conquer. So you have to be a solid base runner. You have to play defense. You also have to hit. You have to hit the curveball. So there's so many elements of it. So you could excel and maybe be major league caliber when you get drafted. But fairly soon, as you climb the ladder and up the ranks, you will find that you'll get exploited for the other things you don't do. And that's the beauty of baseball. It's a day-to-day exchange. And you're constantly updating your information on your opponent, on yourself. So to sort of be able to conquer all these things right out of college was just not possible, certainly where I was. There are very, very rare exceptions. There's a guy with Cincinnati Reds who's pitching now who didn't play in the minor leagues, but that is extremely rare. But outside of the experience on the field, it's off the field. It's the emotional development. You're 20 years old. you're thrust in an environment. You have to learn how to be on the road, away, manage your money, deal with your social environment. That's another learning experience. How do you talk to the press? So all these things are part of your development. And because baseball is so specialized and it takes a lot of time to develop, then you really do need some minor league time. And I think that's a tremendous asset for baseball because it does create a lot more humility, I believe, in the sport than versus other sports where you're able to sort of get drafted and go right to the top.
You played center field, and the name of your book is The Game From Where I Stand. What's special about being in center field?
Well, center field was very personal to me. It was a marriage made in heaven, so to speak, because I always was an observer, and I always enjoyed being able to get this panoramic view of everything. And center field affords you that opportunity. You're in the middle of the outfield. You're in the grass. You can roam free. You are the captain of the outfield, but also you see everything going on in front of you, from where the catcher is setting up, where the shortstop's moving, where my dad is sitting in the stands. You really have this perspective and see everything that the game affords.
You know, there's also, if anybody who's been to ballparks and has sat at various places in stadiums know that there's a special relationship sometimes between fans who sit in the outfield and the outfielder they're nearest. I mean, if you're in the infield, there's a lot of people and there's a lot of noise. But in the outfield, it's kind of a little quieter out there. And I wondered if outfielders can hear individual hecklers.
Well, it's all about timing. And the hecklers that are really good know when to yell at you. So you hear them loud and clear. You know, it's a little downtime. The pitching coach is out visiting the guy who's struggling with his curveball. And all of a sudden, you're out there and you hear the guy yelling. So, of course, my favorite comment was a guy who had done a lot of research on my history. I realized I was an engineer who did a paper about building a new stadium at 30th Street Station in Philadelphia. So I was really struggling when I first came over to Philly in 1998, struggling, hitting like 190. So the guy yelled out, "Hey, Glanville, why don't you design a stadium you can hit in?" So I thought that was very witty. And, of course, he said it when it was you could hear mosquitoes and crickets out there. So, you know, that I had to tip my cap to that guy, but I've heard worse, certainly. But, you learn to kind of tune it out, but you will hear it. There's no way around it.
Now, an outfielder who can roam the field like an antelope and snag any ball hit there is not going to be in the big leagues unless they can hit. And you became a leadoff hitter, which is a special, you know, species in the game. What was your job as a leadoff hitter that was different from just swinging a bat?
Well, my job actually was debatable, and I think that's the beauty of the discussion that baseball affords. Like, I think most people would say that a leadoff hitter's job is to get on base, and that's the simplest version of it, to say get on base any way, any shape, and any way, anyhow.
Which means part of that, take a walk, get hit.
Get hit, lay down a butt. But the one that's quantifiable, which is walking, getting hit by pitch, which goes into your stat column as on-base percentage, is one way. Now, you could get on base in other ways, like reaching on an error or something along those lines. So the on-base percentage is something that haunts a leadoff hitter. You're always measured up against this number 400. 40% of the time you get on base safely. I was nowhere near that. So that was a little bit of my problem because I was below that, probably 325. I'm guessing a little bit about what my career average was. So I was much more aggressive for a prototypical leadoff hitter. So when I wasn't hitting, that was the problem because I wasn't going to take a walk, and therefore I wasn't getting on base that often. But I would contend that there's other ways to be an effective leadoff hitter, one of which is if you have the speed, you put pressure on the other team. The defense has to rush throws. If you do get on base however way, they have to pay attention to you because you might steal the next base. I think there's factors in being aggressive. Getting a hit is different than getting, working a walk because now you've probably moved the runner an extra base instead of one base. So there's ways that you can offset not being a great on-base percentage by being a spark and putting pressure on the defense.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned in the book was that there was a period whenever you led off a game, you were the number one in the batting order, but whenever you led off a game, you would enter the batting box with your head down. Why?
You know, it was a ritual. You know, when you lead off a game, one of my teammates used to say, "You go, we go. You are the spark. You start the engine, and you need to sort of get into sort of almost like a spiritual space to start off, a great game." So I used to do that as a sort of tone setter to figure out, okay, where am I? Let me get my mind clear and then get started. So I would look down, and of course, Greg Maddux learned how to exploit that at some point, as smart as he is, because he would study the films and realize I'd walk in the, you know, get in the batter's box with my head down, and he started quick pitching the first pitch of the game. And so every time I looked up, it was no balls and one strike within 2 seconds. So I started to put one eye on him, and he, you know, he took me out of my game, so I had to figure out ways to take him out of his.
Right. Maddux, of course, the terrific pitcher for many years for the Atlanta Braves. Right. You know, the other thing you see in baseball is if you get a hit and you go to first base, you'll sometimes see a little casual chat with the opposing team's first baseman. And in the warm-ups, you know, you guys are sharing the field. There might be a little chatter here. And I always wondered whether there's any unwritten rules about how friendly you can be with the competition, whether managers, coaches, other players felt like you shouldn't be talking to those guys.
Well, I think that parallels sort of maybe how our country is run. You have sort of federal mandates and then you have state mandates. State mandates are something like talking at first base, which is basically team by team. So the teams, some teams are like, oh, okay, you could talk a little bit. Other teams are not that friendly with it. I know the Cubs, when I first came up, were not into fraternization. They didn't like it. So you, when you had to run in the outfield when you were warming up, you had to run at an angle or bow out towards the fence because they didn't want you to connect with the other team that was running from the other foul line. So that was one way the Cubs handled it. Now, when it came to conversation, what did we talk about at first? It was mostly idle chatter. I mean, if you got a hit, you were feeling pretty good. So you'd look for some sort of acknowledgement from the first baseman. Or you'd say, oh, yeah, way to swing it, man. That's all right. Or, you know, but you don't have a lot of time over there at first base because, especially if you're a base stealer like myself, you got to get ready to take that bag. You got to steal that base. So you don't have time for too many pleasantries. There was guys like JT Snow, for example, that didn't speak to me until maybe my last year. So it was about 8 years before he actually said something. I don't know what that was about, but I guess he finally warmed up eventually.
You know, I looked at your stats before I came to the interview, and you really had some terrific years. I mean, you had years where you had 200 hits, where you were in the, you know, top 10 or 20 in the league in stolen bases and batting average. But eventually, of course, you reach your 30s, and things change. And I wonder, as you got toward the end of your playing career, could you feel your skills degrading?
Well, I definitely felt differently, certainly. I mean, one of the biggest and clearest examples is that I got hurt. And I had never been on the disabled list my entire career. And then all of a sudden in Texas, I signed as a free agent. I'm excited about the future. I'm starting again that I wasn't the year before in Philadelphia in 02. And then I tear a hamstring tendon, just something basic as running down the baseline. So I knew then that I was getting older in this game. And it wasn't just roll out of bed and hit anymore. It was stretch, prepare, weight train, lift. And even though I'd been doing some of those to get ready for a game before, now I had to do it at an exponentially more intense level. So, you know, this was part of the rite of passage of a player. And you know that you're going to get older and slow down. Now, I don't think my speed necessarily changed, but it was the ability to explode or how the preparation it took to actually get that speed. So when you're spending more time getting ready for the game than actually playing the game, you know you're getting older. So it was pretty clear that it was changing for me.
You know, for you and a lot of players, you toward the end of your career, you would play you know, platoon roles where you would only play some games, or you'd be on the bench and pinch hit or come in late in the game as a defensive replacement for another outfielder. Talk a little bit about what it's like mentally to be in that role after spending many years as a starter.
Well, it's a very difficult transition, especially not only many years professionally as a starter. I started since I was 5. You know, I mean, I was a kid and I was used to being the guy, being the starter. So it was very shocking to change and try to adapt to the new culture of being a role player or a fourth outfielder, as they say in my case. But, you know, you do learn and you do watch other guys go through it earlier and you recognize it could be your time. But it doesn't necessarily make it easier to transition into being this guy that has to all of a sudden start stretching in the sixth inning in the locker room because you may pinch hit or pinch run late in the game and it's April and it's 40 degrees and you can't get loose. I mean, this is not a very easy transition. So I went through that primarily in 2004, and quite frankly, it was a very frustrating year. I didn't perform well for sure, but I also was just miserable in trying to figure out how to be ready every day And the times that I did start, it seemed like I was facing a Cy Young winner every day. So it just made it worse for me. But, you know, players all come to that fork in the road, and you have to make that decision if you want to go out on top as a starter or, you know, hang on in the game a long time as a role player and accept that this is going to be your dynamic.
Well, you know, one thing I don't think I realized until I read your book was that a lot of times when people are in those fill-in positions, they will be plopped in by the manager on a day when the best opposing pitcher is on the mound, so that not only do you not get to play very often, but you get to come off cold and face the toughest guys in the league. Why do they put you in that role?
Yeah, that is no fun at all. No fun at all. Well, you know, in some cases, in my case in particular, Marlon Byrd was emerging, and he was the Byrd era was beginning, and Glanville era was kind of moving out.
I mean, he was the up and coming center fielder for the Phillies, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So he was about to replace me as this next guy. Now, I did go to Texas and came back, and Marlon shined that year. So in 2004, that was his job basically. So I took a reduced role. So I was a mentor to Marlon and helped him learn the position. But on the flip side, when Marlon started struggling early on, they didn't want him to play against the toughest pitchers. So what they would do is they'd say, okay, Glanville would play on these guys to give Marlon a break and make sure he keeps his confidence so that he can get going against the weaker pitchers, I'll say. As a result, my schedule looked like this. 2 weeks, you know, not play. And then when I did play, it was Tom Glavin. It was Al Leiter. It was Randy Johnson. It was Brad Radke. It was, you know,
Don Trell Willis. The best pitchers out there.
I mean, these guys were Cy Young winners. I mean, most of them. And so to try to get your A game going after you've kind of sat and you have no rhythm is very tough. And the guys that do it, I tip my cap. But it was a really difficult thing for me to try to figure out how to be ready. In that Radke case, they didn't even tell me that I was playing that day. I got to the stadium. It was a day game. It was like 9 o'clock. And they're like, oh, by the way, you're in the lineup. There was a day in San Diego where Pat Burrell got hurt. I didn't find out till it was the game, you know, right before the game. So that's what happens when you're the role player. You don't have the cushy life of, oh, well, you know what? You're the starter. You're the guy. You know, don't worry about it. Just get ready. Now you have to just be ready on call. And that is not very easy when you're accustomed to being the guy and starting every day.
I think you finished your career as doing a spring training with the New York Yankees, hoping to earn a spot on their club. And then I guess a week before the season, they gave you your release. Was it hard to let go of the game then?
Well, it was a tough moment because despite having what I considered good options, you know, I had this wonderful Ivy League engineering degree. I could do a lot of different things. I certainly knew how to make a living only through baseball. That was my life. That was my livelihood. And so there's no really preparing for that moment where someone gives you the pink slip and says, oh, you know what? You know, we don't need your services. So even though I knew I was getting older, I still had to deal with that transition. And the Yankees called me in the office a week to go in spring training in 2005 and said, you know, sorry, but, you know, we just don't feel like this is, you know, going to work and we have to let you go. And it was a moment where I spent a week in my apartment in Tampa, Florida, waiting to see if there was another team that would call. And most of the calls I got were front office jobs. Oh, you want to be a GM or something? I was like, you know, I'm still looking for a job here. What are you guys doing? You know, I can still play. But then eventually the San Diego Padres called and they offered me a AAA contract, which I was not interested in doing. I was really thinking Yankees or bust or major leagues or bust. And I really thought about it, and I had met my wife, and I was sort of like, you know, I've kind of done it.
Did you ever play ball, sandlot, softball, anything?
No, I haven't really picked up a bat. I picked up a bat at my wedding. We had a very creative rehearsal dinner. Instead of the traditional dinner, we had a barbecue at a minor league stadium, and we took batting practice and had a home run derby. So that's the last time I picked up a bat and really tried to hit a ball hard.
How long ago were you married?
2005, yeah, so about 5 years.
You know, I have all these memories of you hitting high fastballs, and you haven't picked up a bat in 5 years? That makes me want to cry.
Yeah, in some ways I want to cry too about it. It's just sort of a new day. I will get back to the game on the field. I'm confident. My son is not quite old enough yet, but soon I'm sure he's going to get into it. I mean, I'm going to have my daughter out there. I think she she's you know, already shown to be like a good athlete at 8 months, you know. So I'll get back to it. I'll probably go to fantasy camp maybe, you know, one of these days. But I don't want to do it before I'm 40. You know, I'm still under 40, and I don't want to go out there and realize I could have still played. That's frustrating. So I need to go until I've like lost even more of a step, and then I'm like, okay, I should be in this fantasy camp.
Well, Doug Glanville, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Doug Glanville is a sports columnist for the New York Times and a baseball analyst for ESPN. His new book is called The Game From Where I Stand. You can read the first chapter and find links to all of Glanville's columns on baseball on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Rodrigo Garcia, wrote and directed the new film Mother and Child, which is about adoption from several different points of view. Annette Bening plays a woman who got pregnant at the age of 14 and gave up the child for adoption. That child, who is an adult now, feels abandoned by her mother. She's played by Naomi Watts. Kerry Washington plays a woman trying to adopt a child. Garcia's work usually focuses on relationships. He directed several episodes of the first season of HBO's In Treatment about a psychiatrist and his patients. Garcia's father is the Nobel Prize-winning writer Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Let's start with a scene from Mother and Child. Kerry Washington and her husband are at a Catholic adoption agency explaining to the nun why she and her husband are ready for a child. The nun is played by Cherry Jones.
We've been married for 4 years, and we've been trying from the beginning, but we just haven't been able to. And we've been hoping, you know, against hope, as they say, but that just isn't going to be. And we've accepted that. And we're not bitter. I mean, I don't think. Do you think we're bitter about it? No, we're not. So we could be good parents. You know, Joseph is a very tender man. He's affectionate. And we could learn to love a baby in a minute, even if it wasn't ours. Would we get to name the baby ourselves?
It depends on the circumstances. Sometimes the biological parents and the adoptive parents agree on a name.
We could agree to agree. Well, we're ready now to adopt. I mean, blood is important, but it's the time spent together that really matters. Isn't that right?
That's a scene from Mother and Child. Rodrigo Garcia, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to center your movie on three women whose lives revolve around adoption?
My original idea was not about adoption at all. I was actually interested in people who, you know, who are separated, who for some set of circumstances, be it, you know, exile, distance, divorce, death, whatever, sort of live apart from one another and live, you know, longing for one another, a person who sort of has the ghost of an absent one in their lives. So I thought I would, you know, take a mother and child separated at the baby's birth, and that, you know, I made the mother 14 so that clearly she had not made an informed decision. It had been made for her. And the story would really start, you know, 35 years later when the women have never met and are fully grown, and they are, you know, making their way in the world with that absence in their lives. You know, they're each other's ghost, as it were. And then later, you know, I introduced the character of Lucy, played in the movie by Kerry Washington, and she's a third woman who's looking to adopt a baby. And I always thought of her as also having that absent person in her life that she longs, and it's, you know, that baby that she dreams of that she's never met yet.
One of the questions that some characters ask of other characters in the movie is, do you believe in God? Why did you want to put that in?
You know, when I was doing the research about, you know, some of these adoption stories, accounts and memoirs that people wrote about, you know, it seemed to me, and again, I'm talking about the old system, what they call the closed adoption, the secret adoption, the one that was, you know, surrounded pregnancies and adoptions with shame. It seemed to me that a lot of people who had gone through the looking for someone, trying to find someone, trying to connect, felt a little bit under this sense that life had been fated. You know, if I had been given to this family, or if this family had adopted me instead of this other one, You know, the stories of looking for each other were full of near misses and coincidences. You know, women who, you know, might be looking for each other out in the world, and then they would eventually find out that for 5 years, without knowing it, they had worked in the same building, or, you know, lived in the same city at the same time. Fate, circumstance, a feeling of coincidence seems to hover over these stories. And, you know, it just, for me, it inspired the question, you know, is it a fluke? Is it luck? Is it the die rolling? Or is someone, you know, calling the shots? I am not a religious person, so my first instinct is not to think, you know, that there's divine intervention. But, I honestly don't, you know, who pulls the strings of some of these extraordinary coincidences of people meeting or missing each other.
You mentioned that you did research. What kind of research on adoption did you do?
I only read accounts. You know, I did not read specialists. I read memoirs, diaries, interviews with people who had, you know, been separated. And I use it as an active verb because, again, I'm not talking mostly about, you know, women who were older and who made informed adult choices to say it's better for me and for this unborn baby if I, you know, put the baby up for adoption. I'm talking mostly about, you know, very young girls in the 50s, 60s, even the early 70s who, you know, were pretty much forced, first of all, to hide their pregnancy and then to give up the baby. So, the movie was never about adoption. It's not a treatise on adoption. It's not a primer on adoption. You know, it's a look at the nature of a separation, of a forced separation.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer and director Rodrigo Garcia. His new movie is called Mother and Child. He also was the showrunner on In Treatment and directed and wrote many episodes. Since you've done a lot of series television, particularly for HBO, I'm wondering if you feel cramped writing a movie compared to having like a whole season for characters to evolve.
The truth is most of the television I've done for HBO, I've directed episodes and I've directed pilots, but I haven't written them. In the case of In Treatment, I was the showrunner, which, you know, in some ways, you know, is considered the head writer. There's a writing team, but, you know, I'm the showrunner is the head writer. We were adapting the show from an extraordinary Israeli show called Beti Pool, which was just, I thought, wonderful. And I thought it could definitely translate into practically any, you know, Western country for sure. Of course, we did work. You always adapt and you always try to improve on in whatever area that you can. But, you know, that show was very good and very strong. So I have never in TV had to face the blank page completely, as it were. I think it's daunting to be a creator showrunner of a show. I don't know how, you know, the men who run, 24 or Lost or, you know, certainly Sopranos, Six Feet Under. I don't know where, you know, they have the wherewithal to come up. You know, they have writing staffs, but still hour after hour. I mean, that's something that I feel, you know, could crush me.
In adapting the Israeli TV series into the HBO series In Treatment, can you think of an example of something that didn't translate from the Israel version to the American version?
You know, I think in some ways we did not soften any of the conflicts. You know, we left the conflicts as they were, and wherever we could up the conflict, we did. Perhaps, and, you know, I'm saying this with a bit of a chuckle because I think people who've seen both series recognize it. There is a more direct way of dealing that the Israeli doctor and patient have with each other. You know, there is a way of talking to each other that I think by American standards would just be very brash. But I think, I think Israelis, at least in my experience with Israeli friends and Israeli acquaintances, you know, they're very comfortable talking very directly to each other. And I think, you know, in the U.S., people are more circumspect or more polite or, you know, more, they want to sort of sometimes beat around the bush, whereas, even in therapy, you know, whereas the Israeli characters really went at each other. So we did have to change, I think, the tone of how people spoke to each other. And that's just a cultural thing. You know, it was still therapy, whether you're talking directly or indirectly. You know, the Israeli characters, like the American characters, were often lying to themselves also.
My favorite storyline in treatment is the storyline between the therapist, played by Gabriel Byrne, and his therapist, played by Diane Weiss. So I thought I'd play a clip from an episode that you developed and directed from season one. And in this episode, Paul, the therapist played by Gabriel Byrne, he's had an infatuation, really, with one of his patients who's been very flirtatious with him, even to the point of, like, describing in great detail, kind of pornographically, sexual encounters she's had with men. She's also had an affair with one of his other patients, as if to try to create jealousy on the therapist's part. So the therapist really wants to have an affair with her. He wants to sleep with her. But he knows that his therapist will say that that's wrong. So here's a scene between Paul and his therapist, who's played by Diane Weist.
I know you think it's a problem that I have this jealousy over Laura's affair with Alex.
No, not necessarily.
Jealousy is not on your list of reactions a therapist should have, or is it a list of no-no feelings?
Is that what you want from me, a list? Would that make it easier?
I doubt it.
Oh, you keep putting words in my mouth. Maybe you want me to be unreasonable so you have something to push against.
This topic always brings us back onto shaky ground, doesn't it?
What topic?
The boundaries between therapist and patient. Teachers marry students. There's no big deal about it. Is it really wrong?
It's different, Paul.
I remember Charlie, your patient. He used to call me after sessions and he'd say, "There's no sex with the therapist thing. It's driving me crazy. Is it for real? There's got to be a loophole. Am I never going to get to sleep with Gina?" Okay, let's say I stop Laura's therapy. Let's say I send her to somebody else as you want me to do. Surely in 6 months' time I can call her up and say...
No, you can't.
All right,
you
then
can't.
A year, 18
no,
months
Paul,
when it's cooled
no,
off.
No, there's no cooling off period. It's not about cooling off. It doesn't change the dynamic. In 6 months or 10 years, she'll still be a patient.
But that's just some lawyer came up with.
No, it's not a law. It's beyond a code of ethics. It's essential. It's something you carry inside you. Can't you see that?
So what you're saying is that there is no conceivable set of circumstances in
none.
Christ, you're so fundamentalist. You know, there's a lot of people who would disagree with this.
Then go to them.
That's Diane Weist and Gabriel Byrne in a scene from season one of In Treatment, and that episode was directed and developed by my guest Rodrigo Garcia. Watching this series, I always wondered, how could Paul, the therapist, be such a really good therapist most of the time, but be such, like, a really petulant patient, you know, like a really irritating patient?
It's worth clarifying that, you know, part of the problem is the relationship between Paul, played by Gabriel Byrne, and the character Gina, played by Diane Weist, is that the nature of their relationship is very messy. You know, she calls him on it more than once. Are you here as a patient, or do you want me to be your supervisor? Are you asking my opinion as a colleague? Are you asking my opinion as a friend? That's why their discussions, like the one we just heard, get so messy, you know, and it doesn't sound like patient therapist because they keep it messy, you know. They
and
get
she,
themselves...
she used to supervise him when he was studying.
Yes, she used to supervise him, and also, you know, he was her protege back when. You know, they've gone into this, and it's messy, and I think he keeps it messy. I think he keeps it messy to try to gain the advantage and try to get her to agree with him in these very dicey propositions that he's making. But, you know, fine actors. I have to say, I had not heard this exchange for a long time, maybe a couple of years, and they are so, you know, well suited to each other.
Oh, they're
and
great
they're just,
together.
They're
yeah.
just, it's a great dynamic, and no one lets anyone off the hook.
You know, Diane Weist, she was really a revelation to me in this. You know, I've seen her in movies, but I've never seen her be so kind of self-contained. Like, there's so much that she's very still physically. She's just always sitting in the chair, very, very still and calm. And you could see all these things flickering on her face, like sadness, grief, anger, but it's all very contained,
A lot is made in TV and movies of dialogue, and, you know, great dialogue is great, and it can be fun and snappy and provocative. But, you know, what great actors do, which is great, and what movies do, and TV, and it's intoxicating, is not, you know, people talking, but people listening, you know, people reacting. And an actor like Diane, you know, it's... You can see the thought, you know, on her face and eyelids and the twitch of a cheek. I mean, it's like this pool of intelligence, emotion, insight.
Now, Warren Light, who was, I think, one of the chief writers on the series, was quoted as saying one of the qualifications to write for the series was to have been in therapy. Did you already have that on your resume?
I did have it. I was the showrunner the first year, and Warren was the showrunner the second year. So we didn't really overlap. But yes, I had that. I mean, I'm not a lifer, but I had I had some good experience with it. Yes.
Well, now, was that helpful to writing the show, or were the characters in the show so different, and were the confrontations so much more theatrical that your experience didn't quite apply?
Well, it all applies, and it's funny how much of therapy overlaps with drama. You know, the patients want something. Sometimes they know what it is. Sometimes they don't. They come to therapy looking for it. Sometimes they won't admit that they're looking for it. Sometimes they come to therapy to talk about one subject, and once they're there, they avoid talking about it for days, months, sometimes years, sometimes a lifetime. You know, there were just some dramatic choices that the original creators made that really, I think, were genius regarding the show. First of all, you know, to center the show around the shrink's own crisis. Of course, the patients have to work, and they were very engaging, and, you know, they all had to work individually. But at the center of the show is the doctor's own crisis. And of course, seeing him with his sessions with his own supervisor, you know, helped you get to know him better. But yes, I mean, everything, you know, you draw from everything, and your own experience lying to yourself in therapy is very useful.
Now, in addition to working on In Treatment for HBO, you directed episodes of 6 Feet Under, the pilot of Big Love, an episode of The Sopranos. Do they all have different styles? Did you have to learn different styles for each of those shows?
They do have different styles, and I learned their own styles from those shows. You know, I think Big Love is a little different because I did the pilot, and I think in the pilot you work with the creators of the show, the people who wrote the pilot. Mark Olson and Will Sheffer in particular wrote Big Love, and it was just a very good script. You know, I worked with them to bring the pilot together and create a tone for the pilot and a mood for it, etc. That's different from visiting an episodic show like I did on Sopranos or 6 Feet Under. It's great fun and it can be done well and I truly enjoy it, but, you know, I don't want to come in and reinvent anything. You know, I try to watch as many episodes as I can of a series when I'm first on it. If I can, I watch every episode of the series in order so that I'm really soaked in it, and that I learned that tone from the series, and I go in and I work in that key, as it were. You know, I'm not coming in to reinvent. I still want to contribute, do it well, look at performance, try to, you know, give the scenes a spark, make it vivid and juicy, but I'm working in the key of Sopranos, in the key of 6 Feet Under.
Your father is the novelist Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who's best known for his books 100 Years of Solitude and Love in the Time of Cholera. He won a Nobel Prize for Literature in 1982. So he wrote screenplays in addition to novels. When you were growing up, did you think that writing novels were any more important than screenplays from watching your father work?
No. I mean, it was all storytelling. You know, I grew up in that environment where, you know, storytelling was always in the foreground, you know. All of my parents' friends were, you know, writers, poets, screenwriters, painters, some actors, some playwrights. It was all equally good, you know, everything from telling a good joke well to writing a novel, it was all highly regarded. And when I was a kid, my father not only wrote, but he would also write screenplays, usually co-write them, often with directors. So, you know, him sitting in the living room hashing out a story with a director was, you know, also part of our childhood.
Did he talk about writing a lot, and did you pick up things about writing just from conversations?
Yeah, he was always talking to other writers, and, you know, I never thought that I was going to be a director, much less a screenwriter. I always was interested more in images, in being a still photographer or in camera work. When I sat down to write what became my first movie, my first screenplay, it was hard to write, but, you know, I had picked up, you know, on some of the way, you know, writers write and rewrite and where inspiration might come from and how you develop inspiration into an idea and an idea into something dramatized, into a story. So I did have, you know, a sort of a knowledge of what the bones of what it is, you know, what you need to do to write.
Now, your father was famous for magical realism, where, you know, magical or surreal things are happening in otherwise realistic settings. You write very intimate stories where the plot revolves around your characters' relationships and their emotional lives. Do you see yourself as working in some ways in opposition to your father's work?
You know, I work for, you know, I write the script that comes out of me. You know, I don't think, you know, is this like him? Is this not like him? You know, I grew up in a world very different from his. I mean, we grew up in the same household, but he as a kid grew up in 1920s and 30s small town in Colombia, a small town that had seen better days, you know, where he heard stories, you know, from his great uncles and great aunts and grandparents. You know, I had a upbringing in Mexico City as a, you know, middle-class kid with money who traveled. And, you know, it's such a different upbringing that, you know, I chose something that's an expression of what I've seen and what I've heard, you know. And in some ways, it's not by design, but I'm glad we work in very different worlds. You know, that way I haven't had to suffer the comparison, at least, of the worlds.
So you were born in Colombia, but you grew up in Mexico City. Did you see a lot of TV and movies growing up in Mexico City, and were many of them American?
I did watch, you know, more TV than I should have, I think. You know, I think back then there was less concern with how many hours of TV we watched. A lot of the shows were American. You know, I did as a kid watch, you know, dubbed into Spanish, everything from, you know, the Flintstones to the Addams Family to Mr. Ed, the Brady Bunch, La Familia Brady. but also movies. I mean, I was not a movie geek by any standard, but, you know, in my teens already, my father's own taste in film started, you know, trickling down to my brother and I. And, you know, he was a big fan of Truffaut in particular and of Kurosawa. So, you know, those were directors that we were, you know, very familiar with.
When you were growing up in Mexico, did you watch any of those Mexican vampire movies?
Of course, and the vampire movies and the wrestling movies, and often the wrestling movies with vampires in them.
Oh, I haven't seen any of those.
Oh, the combination is endless, believe me, and maybe a Frankenstein monster somewhere in the back.
So did you watch them for fun when you were older or just like when you were younger?
Yeah, no, just as a kid. It's not really my genre, except, of course, you know, sometimes there are excellent examples of that genre. But mostly, you know, I've always been a fan of, you know, the kind of movie that I like to make, you know, that I try to make, which is, you know, the contemporary, you know, realistic, psychological movie.
Now, there was a period when I think your father was considered subversive by the United States and he was denied a visa to the United States. And I'm wondering what impact that had on you.
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, we grew up in a world, of course, in the 60s and 70s, you know, my parents were left-wing and they were openly left-wing. So, of course, you know, the role of the U.S. in Vietnam, in Chile, in Argentina, and, you know, the training of death squads for Central America, I mean, that was considered, of course, the enemy. On the other hand, you know, my father had great American friends and a great love and admiration for the U.S., and he always said that his biggest regret not it was not being fluent in English so that he could, you know the country better. And of course, you know, writers like Hemingway and Faulkner had been really, you know, instrumental in making, to some extent, the writer that he was. So, yeah, so I found myself in a situation where I was in college here in the U.S. in a country where my father could hardly get a visa to visit, except maybe like a one-time entry or something like that.
So another question about your father. Have you ever used him as a first reader, or would you prefer he be more of a last reader?
You know, he's someone who reads my scripts when I'm, you know, in early pre-production, and he's always been very supportive. In fact, he's an easy reader. In that sense, he's not an ideal reader for feedback because he's quick to be supportive. And he, you know, he's very high on my films and my television work and shows it off to his friends shamelessly.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Rodrigo Garcia wrote and directed the new film Mother and Child. You can watch clips from the film on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for digital media. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Tariq Rose.